You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Welcome to the second half of the year, everyone.
Yeah, we are.
Let's hope it was as good as the first
half. Officially half over. Oh,
this is one of the longest first halves of a year I think I've ever experienced in my life.
It was different, all right. The thing that I think that's happened over the last week in terms of the whole COVID craziness is the real escalation of the mask wars as a cultural war in the U.S., which is just crazy.
Absolutely.
I guess we'll fight over anything, right?
It's hard to be, to be surprised after everything we've seen. But this is a little bit surprising. People fighting against the masks is just wow.
But you know what? It's not that surprising if you know a little history, because the same exact thing happened in 1918 during that flu pandemic. There was a general recommendation to wear masks, and there was actually an anti-mask league of people pushing back against mask wearing.
And you're saying that specifically here in the U.S., right?
I think it's elsewhere as well. Like, I think the U.K. is having a little bit of a pushback, but I think it's primarily...
I meant the historical component.
The historical component was not just in the U.S. That was even more over in Europe.
Interesting.
The current anti-mask nonsense is mainly a U.S. phenomenon, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is happening elsewhere as well, just not as much.
So I've been seeing some really interesting assertions about the fact that some of the kind of underlying ideology really comes down to the fact that historically America, and you're right, some kind of European nations as well, especially the U.K., kind of pride themselves on an individualistic society as opposed to a collectivist society. And obviously everybody falls somewhere on the continuum of those two things. But America has sort of a long history of being very individualist and very proud of it. And that kind of mentality could have some explanatory power when we talk about these anti-mask fights.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. If you look like there was famously now like testimony in Florida from people who are pushing back against mask wearing. And the big theme was liberty and freedom. You're not going to tell me what to do. But there was some subset of them woven religious themes, like this, you're covering God's face or whatever.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah. That makes no sense.
It
I know.
There's religions who you're supposed to cover your head. And,
right,
and other
in a lot
things
of religion.
Whatever. And then the other theme was pseudoscience, right? It was making claims that, masks are unhealthy, or they don't work. Same, like just exactly like the anti-vaxxers, the same kind of playbook.
So, I wonder how much of that is just like trying to find justification for that liberty
claim. It's 100%.
Like this idea that I'm more concerned about my own comfort than I am about the well-being of others. It's really representative of an individualist view that's hard to extricate, because it's like it's so woven into society that kids in America are born thinking that way, depending on how multicultural, bicultural, whatever you are, how many generations you've lived here. But when you look at collectivist societies, the idea that somebody would make a decision for their own betterment at the expense of other people's welfare is like bananas to them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think like we were saying, there is a huge component here of it being a political statement.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing a lot of work, heavy lifting type of work with a mask on, prepping for Nexus. And it's harder to breathe when you have a mask on, but they've proven that you're not at a loss for oxygen. Like you're not suffering from a lack of oxygen because you're wearing a mask. It just restricts your breathing a little bit. It's like trying to breathe through, a straw of a certain size.
Well, it just feels a little claustrophobic, but
yeah, it sucks. But
you have what else restricts your breathing worse?
What?
COVID.
Yeah, COVID.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right, Jay. It does not restrict your ability to get oxygen into your blood, and it doesn't cause you to rebreathe the CO2. Enough of it is getting out. The thing is, you have to keep in mind, surgeons have been wearing masks for hours a day for their entire adult careers for hundreds of years or whatever, at least 100 years. So this is not a new thing. And what about, I've gone skiing all day with a neoprene face mask for 8 hours at a time. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, but that's fun, no problem. Steve. That's not work.
I'm just saying that people think about people wear essentially functionally face masks in cold environments for long stretches of time. Not an issue. So it's just, it really is nonsense. People have been passing around these fake like exemption cards, but they're totally bogus.
Oh, yeah, I saw those. Yeah. What a,
yeah, they're
what
BS.
And it's so frustrating because there are, you know, a handful of people for whom they really can't wear a mask because they have, you know, such a severe psychiatric issue or even some sort of medical exemption. But also, probably there's a big overlap between the people who would really need a medical exemption and a severe risk of if they contract COVID, they're going to not fare as well. So those people probably shouldn't be spending as much time in public places anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the CDC just lists three specific exemptions.
Oh, okay, what are they?
Well, one is like people who have autism and cannot tolerate the sensory overstimulation.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
the second is people who have like pathological claustrophobia type reaction or like a PTSD.
Like diagnosable.
Kind of, kind of response. As you said, so psychiatric. And the third is some severe respiratory. Like you have to have like really severe respiratory disease where just the physical breathing, like as Jay said, a little bit of restriction, the physical breathing could actually be significant. But that's it. That's really it.
But yeah, those people need to be much more concerned about potentially catching COVID anyway.
Yeah, they're
the mask, the final
the mask
category.
Is the least
of
the problem. But people who are just going about living their lives saying, oh, I don't wear a mask, you know.
No excuse.
Yeah, you're not like shopping at Target and having like a meltdown with a Target employee over a mask if you fall into one of those three categories.
Exactly.
It's not likely that that's happening.
So it's unfortunate. And again, the evidence is piling up. None of it's perfect, right? All the evidence is observational because you can't do a double-blind, randomized, you know, controlled trial with something like this. You have to look at real-world data, which is observational. But there's been many studies. Yeah, common sense sometimes could be misleading, and so we definitely do want to study it. But it's showing that it does in fact work. The states and the countries that have more strict requirements to wear a mask are doing better. They are having less, you know, fewer cases. The states where they don't have a mandate to wear a mask are doing worse. For example, I mean, we've reviewed the data a couple of times on this show now, and yeah, it's not perfect, but there's a strong signal that mask wearing is effective, and it is absolutely a courtesy because you are protecting other people. It protects other people more than you.
That's the point.
You know?
Yeah. I actually saw a pretty interesting data visualization, and we'll talk about data visualizations later in the show, but I wasn't going to mention this specific one that showed, you know, case count, or it might have even been case fatality count, sort of the curve, you know, that we often talk about, the flattening of the curve, and it divided it by states that elected or that voted for Trump versus Clinton in the last election. So they were using that as a rough indicator of political or ideological lines. And they showed that blue states tended to have earlier spikes, likely because of population more than anything.
Yeah.
Because these are big, you know, centers where there were a lot of airports and things like that. But then it showed that red states tended to have, are tending to spike similarly now, and there's now no significant difference between the per capita counts across these states, and that's probably due to mask wearing. So it's like early on it looked like it was a blue state phenomenon, but really that was because of population. Now it looks
urban.
Like it was urban. Now the red state phenomenon is catching up, very likely because of a lack of public health, you know, restrictive public health guidance. Because this thing, it doesn't discriminate. Like, that's the thing that we have to remember. And when we talk about, you know, the public health outcomes because of systemic racism and things like that, those are all built into the system. Like, somebody's, you know, Black Americans have worse outcomes due to COVID, but they have worse outcomes due to all disease. You know, it's like, there's a reason for that. But when it really comes down to, could I catch this thing? Anybody can catch it.
Sure.
Yeah. So it's not over yet.
Not even close.
Yeah, still in the first wave. The U.S. is seeing record numbers now. Record.
Yeah, hit us with the statistics, Steve.
Worldwide cases cracked 10 million. Deaths over half a million. The new daily cases still on the upswing. The daily deaths dipped, but are starting to come back up.
So how many confirmed cases in the U.S.?
So, yeah, we've had at least 125,000 deaths so far in the U.S., at least 2.6 million cases. reported.
And you said 100 and what?
125,000 deaths, 2.6 million cases.
Yeah, and the New York Times is recording a slightly higher estimate, 130,000 deaths and 2.73 million confirmed cases.
Yeah, it's at least 125. That's the low end of the range of estimates. And if you look at the curve in the U.S., we're now in the middle of a second hump, like a second surge.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in the highest per day cases are happening right now.
And the frustrating thing is, like, we did know this would happen to some extent. Like, it's not that I really want to fully defend what's going on in California, because California, I think we're number 5 or 6 in terms of like this bounce back of cases. We were one of the first states to have shelter in place orders. And we've had a lot of really good mandatory restrictions that have really protected us, especially if you compare us to New York, which is probably a valid comparison more than any other city or county or state in the U.S. But now things are looking really, really horrible. And it's this like, it's all about titration to some extent, right? It's like, as you start to reopen, things are going to get bad. And how do you reopen just enough, but not so much? How do you let certain things happen, but not all the things happen? And so there are these balanced things where it's like, okay, and then we got to break it back. And then we got to bring it forward and bring it back. Because it's not about reducing cases. Sadly, people are going to get sick. It's the only way that they can do things like buy groceries. They're going to get sick or go to work. It's, do we want to run out of hospital beds? Do we want to run out of respirators? Like, until there's a vaccine, people are going to get sick. But yeah, we don't want to overwhelm our healthcare. Yeah,
yeah. But you can actually decrease the numbers, not just not just prolong the curve, but you can actually reduce the area under the curve if you do take precautions.
Which we did, but the problem was the whole economy was shut down.
Yeah,
it's all about that balance, right?
Exactly. I wrote about this recently on my blog, the idea that we have to shift now into a sustainable strategy, because a total lockdown is not sustainable. And, you know, with total economic shutdown, you know, the downsides will eventually eclipse the pandemic itself. You know, if we keep, you know, there is a long term, at least a long term, you know, effect on mortality with
unemployment and unemployment, suicide rates. It's terrible.
So yeah, a short-term lockdown because we got taken by surprise by a severe, you know, once in 100 years pandemic, yes. But now we need to figure out how to sustainably minimize this pandemic. That's why, again, this circles back to mask wearing. Mask wearing is what allows you to open up the economy. You know, figuring out how to do things with social distancing, with wearing a mask and quarantining people who are sick and testing people. Like, these are all the strategies that we're going to enable us to open up the economy. But the thing is, the same people who are crying about liberating or opening up, you know, the economy, opening up the states, are the same people who are pushing back against mask wearing. And it's like, you got to choose, pick one. You know, you can't refuse to do the things that we need to do to open up the economy, which is what you say you want to do in the first place. It doesn't make any sense.
Of course not. Yeah. Of course. I mean, it makes perfect sense, but it once you add in the emotional component or the loyalty to your political party component, you know, then things can go off the rails.
Steve, I'd be interested in your take on this. Like, I would love, in a perfect, you know, scenario, to be able to test every single person in this country or every single person on the planet. And then we would have a real understanding of how rapidly this has washed through, and that people who had no symptoms whatsoever have been carrying it.
Yeah.
Because I still think that the number of confirmed cases is a drop in the bucket compared to how many there likely are based on asymptomatic transmission that nobody even thought to get tested for.
Yeah, they're talking about doing that in Texas, just like pick Texas, because that's spiking right now, and doing what they're calling blitz testing. Let's test everybody and identify the silent spreaders, you know, just see what
we're
dealing
with. I'm surprised we haven't done that yet. Like, these little microcosmic studies where it's like, let's test 10,000 people in a region or 20,000 or whatever, and see what percentage of people actually have. The problem is, we didn't have valid antibody tests.
All right, let's go on with the show. Kara, you're going to do a What's the Word? You haven't done one of those in a while.
What's the word?
What's the word? So I came across a little article in Hawkeye magazine that caught my attention. It's actually like a video called Hiding in Plain Sight. A natural phenomenon of light and waves helps prey fish use stealth when running from predators. And as I dug deep into the article, I came across this word, caustics. And of course, we've heard the word caustic a gajillion times. We might have even had it before on the show talking about the difference. I don't remember if we have, but we often will talk about like poisons or toxins or things that are burn or things that do this or that. And so most of us, when we think of the word caustic, what do you think of when you think caustic?
It means that it's like it would operate like an acid. It would eat away something.
Right.
Something that like burns, right?
Yeah.
Caustic agents burns or it's got some sort of a chemical action that's corrosive. And that is the first definition across most dictionaries. But did you also know that there is something called a caustic surface or caustic curve? And it actually relates to the second dictionary definition of caustic, which most people haven't come across, which is the envelope of rays emanating from a point and reflected or refracted by a curved surface. So generally speaking, caustics refers to the ripples of light that you might see on the top of a road or underneath the surface of water when light from the sun is reflected or refracted, whether it's through a window or through the surface of the ocean or, you know, any real other surface, you get that beautiful scattering of light. And the more I started to dig into this phenomenon of caustics, the more I realized that a lot of the internet entries kind of dedicated to caustics are dedicated to graphic design and motion graphics. Because caustics are really important when you're trying to represent what things look like in reality. Because light doesn't just come, you know, as a dispersed blanket from one corner. Like we often think of like still life when we think of graphics. And we think, oh, there's the light source. But light is often scattered and rippling and waving and really beautiful. And so there's a whole article on like the Disney Animation Studios website about how they did Moana and how it was really necessary that they looked at the physics of caustics to be able to do these really beautiful representations. So I thought that was really interesting. And I'd literally never heard of the term before. And as I tried to dig into the etymology of caustics as the secondary definition, the best that I could come up with was that it's still based on the same term. So caustic, when we think of burning or destroying tissue or being corrosive or burning, it comes from the earlier Greek. And ultimately, we started to use it as like also a literary sense, like, you know, somebody can be caustic, like they're really sarcastic, like maybe they're like salty, like they're also caustic, or that was a caustic comment that somebody makes. So that was one way that it evolved. But it does seem like the use of it as this kind of scattering of light is also based on that original use, because light has the potential to burn. And so when it's either condensed, refracted, or reflected, that light can burn what comes into contact with it. And so that seems to be where even this usage of the word caustic came from. Because, of course, light can burn, especially when it's focused, like we all did when we were kids with magnifying glasses. Don't tell.
Well, I used to light the caps on fire. Remember the caps you used to get toy guns? And you would scrape the nail over them, or you could also burn them in the sun, and they would catch fire. It's pretty cool.
And so, but the article that I found from Hawkeye talks about the way that certain types of prey fish actually use all of those lights, the scattered lights below the surface, the water caustics, to flee or to fight or to freeze so that predators can't find them. So they're kind of using light caustics as a natural camouflage and working with it to avoid getting predated, which is pretty interesting.
Cool.
Yeah.
So we've spoken about on the show before about raw milk. Right.
Oh, so it's so good. Come on,
now what?
We're going to get milk emails. It's one of those things that people go crazy about. Just a quick follow up. I'll start with a summary. So about 2-3% of people in the U.S., and I think it's maybe different in other industrialized nations, but not too far off, drink raw milk on a regular basis. Some because they live on a farm, you know, they live in a location where they produce it, so they can get it fresh. But some people buy raw milk at the store because they think it's better, right? And those are the people that I want to talk to, or talk about. So the milk is pasteurized. Pasteurization involves heating milk in a stainless steel container to 161 degrees Fahrenheit for 15 seconds and then rapidly cooling down to 39 degrees Fahrenheit.
See why Fahrenheit's better than Celsius? Go ahead. Whatever. Wait, so, as long as we're going to get the hate milk emails.
The reference hate, I, so. From reference like I found used Fahrenheit. You can translate that to Celsius if you want to. Many European countries prefer ultra-pasteurized milk, which involves heating to 280 to 300 degrees Fahrenheit for 2 to 3 seconds.
Boiling. We have and a lot that, of that here, too.
Yeah, you can get that here, but this
yeah,
is
it
the thing.
It gives you longer shelf life.
It gets you shelf-stable milk. Mm. Right, so you, in other words, you don't have to even refrigerate it. You can just keep milk in the cupboard, you know.
Wow.
Which is weird for Americans. It's like bizarre.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But that, like, what is it?
Carnation milk, right?
Not even carnation. There's a brand that sells them in little, like single use packs, almost like juice boxes, and you can find them in all grocery stores in the U.S. It's just most people aren't looking for them because they're not stored with the refrigerated
yeah,
milk.
Right. Yeah. Right. Because they don't have to be. The question is raw milk have any health advantage over pasteurized milk? So one thing that we could say for sure is that pasteurization works, right? It does do what it's supposed to do, which is kill bacteria. And therefore, it reduces any foodborne infections through milk. Milk as a source of infection outbreaks was reduced from 25% to 1% by pasteurization.
Woohoo.
Wow, that's
the
big.
Number of bacterial outbreaks due to milk decreased from 25 to 1%. There's also, you know, lots of studies showing that if you consume raw milk on a regular basis, you are at higher risk of contracting certain bacterial infections than people who don't drink milk or drink pasteurized milk. So it works. So why would people drink raw milk? Why would they choose to, you know, forego this modern technology that reduces foodborne dangerous infections?
We're so, talking about people who don't have a choice. Or who do have the
no,
choice.
No, no. Yeah, yeah. People who choose. People why would choice. People who yeah. can choose to? So there's three basic justifications for it. One is the claim that raw milk is more nutritious.
I've seen that. I've seen that a lot around yeah. LA.
The second is the claim that it tastes better. And the third Subjective. Is the claim that it contains healthy probiotics.
Although it seems like one and three are almost the same.
No. So nutrition okay. is like, does it have good vitamins and proteins?
Oh, yeah.
And
that the pasteurization process removes healthy
yes, yeah,
components.
Like vitamins. Right. Whereas okay. the probiotics are that there's good bacteria in there. You don't want to kill the good bacteria because it's, you know, it's good for your...
Just to ignore the E. coli.
Yeah, yeah.
For the South.
So, well, that's the question. What's the bacterial makeup of milk, you know, raw milk? So there's lots of evidence, but there's a recent study that looked at both the first and third claims, right? Nutrition and the probiotic claim. So that's what I'm reporting on today. Just as an aside, I looked to see if I could find any double-blind taste tests of raw versus pasteurized milk. I could only find limited, more anecdotal stuff, nothing really blinded. So something may be out there, but in the time that I had, I couldn't find anything. So, you know, in the absence of good blinded studies, I'm just reluctant to make any conclusions about it. And I don't trust when people say, yes, but it tastes better to me because it's so subjective.
Yeah, there's a lot of motivated reasoning behind it.
Yeah, we did those blinded taste tests. We were blown away. You know, by, you know, how things taste when you don't know what it is that you're tasting. I would just say be skeptical, be cautious, and just be open to the fact that there may be a lot of expectation bias and whatever. But it's plausible that there would be differences in taste, both good or bad, right? It could go either way. It's totally plausible. It may just be an acquired taste or a personal preference, not something
that's
more
objective. Yeah,
if you like
grew up on a farm or something.
Whatever. Yeah, if you say you like the taste of raw milk better, fine. I will say that I will grant you that. Okay. But that's not really what we're talking about. We're talking about is it more nutritious and does it have healthy probiotics? So
can I ask you a quick question before you do all your results? Because I don't know if this is going to fit into your story. The milk that I get from the farm, the CSA box, it's pasteurized, but it's non-homogenized.
Yeah,
and
so that's...
They claim that the pasteurization makes it healthier, but the homogenization is what takes, like, additional, quote, nutrients out of it.
They didn't look at that in the study that I'm looking at, but homogenization is just a process so that the cream doesn't float to the top, you know, so you don't have, like, cream at the top and then thinner milk below. It mixes it all together. in a way that it stays that way. So the whole thing has a homogenized, meaning same consistency. But the pasteurization is what we're talking about here.
Okay,
so
cool.
They looked at the macro and micronutrient content of both the regular pasteurization process, the shelf-stable pasteurization process, and whole milk. What they found was basically no significant difference between raw milk and the regular pasteurization. They found that when you do the ultra-pasteurization for shelf-stable milk, it did result in a little bit of a loss of thiamine, which is a specific vitamin. It's one of the B vitamins.
What does thiamine do?
It's important for neurological function, for example, for a lot of things. You know, it's an important cofactor in the body.
Do we mostly get it from milk?
No. That's the thing. For most people, you do not get a significant amount of your thiamine from milk. Thiamine is found in a variety of meats, vegetables, and legumes. Yeah, so you're going to get it from a lot of other sources. The probability that you will be adversely nutritionally affected by drinking pasteurized milk over raw milk is negligible. And again, that was only for the ultra-pasteurized, the shelf-stable milk. And even then, just, you know, and if whatever, if there's some reason that you get all your thiamine from milk, take a supplement. But that, again, it's hard to imagine somebody that where that would be a factor. For most situations, most people, no significant nutritional difference. So the idea that it's more nutritious is just a straight-up bogus claim. So the second claim about probiotics, they found that raw milk, so they basically left the milk, the three types of milk out on the at room temperature. They left them out for a while, and they tracked, serially, repeatedly tested the bacteria in the milk just to see what happens over time. And what they found was that pasteurized milk is completely stable if you refrigerate it. The bacteria does not increase over time. It does increase over time if you leave it out at room temperature. The shelf-stable milk, as advertised, is shelf-stable, doesn't have any significant bacteria in it. Mm-hmm. The raw milk has way more bacteria in it. And what they found was that it has a lot of pathogenic bacteria, and it has no probiotic bacteria.
No probiotic.
So it's only going to potentially make you sick.
Yes. So it's only a risk. There was no, and again, the bigger issue is, should people routinely be taking quote unquote probiotics? And the answer to that is no. There's no evidence that there's any benefit to the routine consumption of probiotics. So just the core claim that raw milk is healthier because it contains raw biotics is bogus.
I don't know. I think you're just being negative about it, Steve.
There's no evidence for that. Mark Crislip has written about that. I've written about it on Science-Based Medicine.
What if your doctor tells you you should take them because you're, there's got to be a reason.
There are specific reasons where it may be helpful. Like if you have irritable bowel syndrome,
right?
If you're taking antibiotics and you can get the antibiotic induced, diarrhea. So there are certain situations where there's weak evidence that it's plausible that it may be helpful, but you have to do it early. You have to do high colony counts, and it's still an open question. But what I said was routine, right? So routine use of probiotics. In other words, if you're otherwise healthy and you don't have any specific medical indication for it, and you're just doing it for daily health maintenance or promotion, there is no evidence of any benefit. And it's not even plausible that it would have any benefit, right? Because your gut microbiota is a complex, stable ecosystem, and probiotics, eating new bacteria just doesn't have an effect on that ecosystem. I love Mark Crislip's, analogies, like planting corn in the rainforest. It's not going to change the ecosystem. This is not going to happen.
Yeah, but that's why when you have C. diff, like one of the more controversial but newer things is poop transplant.
Well, that fecal works.
Yeah, because you got to go through the butt, and that's only
fecal,
if you have such a severe.
Fecal transplants work because you're giving an ecosystem. Mm-hmm. You're not giving one or two or three bacteria.
Yeah,
and it's a relative, right? It's a close relative.
Theoretically, they should have the same sort of ecosystem that you have got.
And because you have such a horrific bacterial infection that it's wiped out your.
Yeah, it's like a band-aid until you can recover your own.
Yeah.
Jay, own bacteria. Jay, would you take my poop?
I mean, look, if I had to, I'd take anybody's if it was going to help me out.
Jay's been taking your shit for years.
I don't take no shit. Steve, so let me clarify this because I'm a little confused. Now, you're saying don't drink more than 3 glasses of raw milk a day.
That's great.
I would say don't drink more than 0 glasses of raw milk a day. So it's a double whammy, right? I always love it when something is wrong in two different ways. It doesn't even have probiotics, and probiotics taken routinely aren't beneficial anyway.
Well, three ways, and it also has a bunch of horrible bacteria.
Yeah, that, well, in terms of the benefit, and it has the risk. So it's all risk, no benefit. That's the story of raw milk. All risk, no benefit. And that's been pretty consistent in the research over decades. And so this study adds to that, but it's consistent with what we already know.
I'm pretty sure it costs a hell of a lot more, too.
Raw milk?
I don't know.
Yeah, like you can
probably
only find
it's
it
like
in
boutique.
Bougie grocery.
Well, maybe they can command a higher price because it is less.
Yeah, it's like organic. You're just charging a premium because of the health halo.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For people who don't know what they're talking about.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't cost more to make. It probably costs a lot less to make.
Yeah,
but
milk
it
without
have the same,
minus the two processes. Yeah.
I think the problem with that would be, I'm guessing, by the way, but I would imagine, Kara, that you know there isn't a whole industry for raw milk, so therefore it probably has to be handled more, where the other you know processed milk is going through like these known systems and ways of selling them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I think that there is the health halo too. I mean, if you want raw milk in LA, you're going to go to like Air One or you're going to go to Lassen's. You're going to go to one of these like bougie health food stores.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
Yeah, that's how you get it.
Yeah. Some people use it to make cheese and stuff, you know, because you need the live culture. But what they were saying, the researchers were saying, it's not safe for that. Because that's why like, if you have to leave it out in order to culture it for certain applications. They say just use the pasteurized milk and add a culture. Don't try to, because the bacteria that in there, it's mostly E. coli. It is mostly E. coli, which is not
enjoy.
Good. All right, let's move on.
Hey, Steve, guys. Thanks for keeping us abreast of the milk situation. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, Evan, that was utterly fascinating.
Whoa.
All right, Bob, so we had murder hornets this year, but you're going to tell us about a monster quasar.
Yeah, those poor murder hornets, though, they didn't really get their time in the sun. The pandemic just kind of took the news. But we'll see how this monster lasts here, this quasar. So, yes, astronomers have found the second most distant quasar in the known universe, hosting a black hole exceeding 1 billion solar masses. It's so big and so far away that it's actually challenging our theories of black hole formation in the early universe. So the designation for this quasar is nasty, J100758, and a whole bunch of other stuff, but it's got a name. It actually has a really cool name. The name is Ponuaena, and it means in Hawaiian, unseen spinning source of creation surrounded with brilliance.
Ooh, wow.
30 Hawaiian immersion school teachers created that name, and it's really beautiful. And I like a cool name for a cool thing instead of just a designation. So this quasar is 13.1 billion light years away, crazy far. The black hole at its core has a mass equivalent of about 1.5 billion suns. This is the farthest object we've ever found that has over a billion solar masses. It's really amazing. They used at least two telescopes that work together to find this bad boy, the Keck and Gemini, famous telescopes. Mm-hmm. But what exactly did they find? Now we've talked about quasars a bunch of times in the past, but I don't think we ever really talked much about their history, which I wasn't aware of some of these details. So Bell Telephone Laboratories in the 30s found static interference on their transatlantic phone lines. And they found out that the static was coming from the Milky Way. I'm not sure how they did that, but that's what they found out. And within a couple of decades, they had radio telescopes to actually find these sources in the Milky Way that was producing the static. But some of them couldn't be found. They couldn't be found at all. And so they call them quasi-stellar radio sources, or quasars, because quasi-stellar, because they were kind of like localized, like a star. But actually, it's a misnomer, like a lot of names in science. Only 10% of quasars actually emit strong radio waves. But it doesn't matter. Quasar is an awesome name and not a designation. Now, quasars are essentially big galaxies in the early universe with a core on steroids. The central black hole is supermassive. And in the early universe, in some probably overdense regions where they're created, there's apparently enough food to eat there, or there was, that would make a hobbit puke. And by food, of course, I mean stars, gas, planets, and other galaxies too as well. Just gobbling up stuff all the time. I mean, that's what you need to get that big. So the accretion disk whirlpooling around the hole and the relativistic jets emitted by the poles are so bright. It's literally the brightest thing in the universe. I mean, obviously, because we could never see it at 13.1 billion light years away if it wasn't amazingly bright. So to put it into perspective a little bit, imagine the light emitting area of this quasar, which is about the size of our solar system, outshining the combined output of the entire rest of the galaxy. And I mean, imagine our solar system, something the size of our solar system, putting out that much energy. So if you took a good-sized quasar, here's another one. I love this one. If you took a good-sized quasar and put it 30 light years from Earth, right? 30 light years, really far away, it would still match our sun in brightness at 30 light years.
That's 30 now, light years.
Absolute brightness?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yes. So that's 93 million miles away, which is our sun, compared to 176 trillion miles away, which is 30 light years. That's how bright it is. It would be as bright as our sun. So these things are insane. I mean, I've been thinking about it. Quasars really are the jewels of the universe. Can you imagine seeing one up close, relatively close, like say a couple galactic diameters, right? It would be even better than the time we walked on that set of the Bridge of the Enterprise. Even better than that. Looking at a quasar. But if you want an even wider perspective about a quasar, there's things called active galactic nuclei, AGN. That includes quasars. It also includes Seyfert galaxies, which are less energetic. And there's also blazars, which are very energetic, similar to quasars as well. But there are some people that think that all three of them are actually the same thing, but seen at different perspectives. Isn't that cool? So it's kind of like it made me think of Jay, right? When we talk to Jay face to face, right? We're talking to him. We refer to him as Jay. But if he's turned around, you know, like, and he's facing us from behind, we refer to him as Flatula, because it's a different perspective.
That's, you know, count Flatula to you, Bob.
So this discovery gets even more interesting. The quasar is so far away that it existed only 700 million years after the Big Bang. And that's like a glove smacked across the face of our models of the growth of supermassive black holes in the early universe. It's like, holy crap, how could something get that big that fast? Dr. Jinyi Yang is a postdoctoral researcher at the Steward Observatory of the University of Arizona. He said, for a black hole of this size to form this early in the universe, it would need to start as a 10,000 solar mass seed black hole about 100 million years after the Big Bang, rather than growing from a much smaller black hole formed by the collapse of a single star. So the birth of galaxies and stars as we know them happened during the epoch of reionization, which is my third favorite epoch after the Big Bang. Just throwing that out there. So this reionization occurred probably, you know, say around 150 billion years after the Big Bang. So for something as big as this quasar to exist at this time, it's hard, very hard to account for with our current models. So that leads then to the future. What are we going to do in the future about this, hopefully? So in order to explain the existence of a quasar like Pohneua-Enna, we probably need to discover a more exotic mechanism to account for the creation of such a black hole seed in the early universe. How was that created? It's not going to be started by one star collapsing at, like, you know, a few solar masses and then increasing from there. It's going to be something much more exotic. So there's hope that machine learning tools, of course, machine learning tools are going to be important in the future, kind of obvious, but those tools in the future are going to work with advanced platforms like the James Webb Space Telescope and ESA's Euclid satellite. And they could potentially find, imagine this, 100 quasars at this distance or even farther. 100. We've only got one at this distance. Well, two. We got basically two quasars at this distance. Imagine if we found 100 or more at that distance. Then that means, of course, that when you have such a statistical sample, we could hopefully make some solid progress outlining not only the boundaries of the reionization epoch itself, but also the black hole growth enigma as well. I'll keep you apprised.
All right.
Yeah.
Sounds very interesting. All right, Evan, this is also kind of a follow-up item, but there was a new study informing us further about what killed the dinosaurs.
Yeah. Oh, God, don't we know this by now?
Well,
that was the asteroid, but yeah. Now we know even more. But go ahead,
it really, really, really was the asteroid.
All right, I'll tee up the controversy for those who don't know. You guys remember 66 million years ago or so, you know, before the internet? It was July 1st in the year 66 million BCE. When the greatest impact in the history of... It wasn't really July 1st. When the greatest impact in the history of modern Earth and life took place. And no, Jay, it wasn't the McDLT sandwich with the hot side hot and the cool side cool. For those of you tuning in to see us on live streams on Friday, you'll know the significance of that remark. No, it was an asteroid. The Earth got walloped by an asteroid. They say it's as large as 50 miles in diameter is what they estimate. But I've also read as perhaps as small as about 10 miles in diameter. And that seems like a pretty significant difference or range. But in any case, it's the Chicxulub Impactor. That's what it's called. And at the time of the impact, in dinosaur language, it was called the holy shit, look at that impactor. How impactful was this thing? Well, think about 10 billion Hiroshima bombs worth of energy released with the impact.
10 billion?
10 billion with Whoa. A B. Tsunamis Whoa. Created hundreds of feet tall. It set the planet's vegetation and forests on fire, hurled debris into outer space, right? Some of it finding a resting place on the moon. And when the asteroid impacted, it produced a doomsday shroud, a lethal cloud of particles and dust which encircled the Earth for 93 years. That's a line from a movie, by the way. About 75% of all life on Earth died as a result in the impact in the days and the weeks and the months that followed, including all non-avian dinosaurs. So therefore, that's what killed the dinosaurs. Wait a second. Perhaps that's not what killed the dinosaurs. Was it actually volcanic eruptions or a series of them? Which began occurring about 600,000 years before the Chicxulub impactor. Now, that particular theory posits that in what is modern-day India, several volcanic seams opened up in the ground, releasing a flood of lava, which, over time, grew to an area the size of the state of Texas, or roughly half of what is India today. It's called the Deccan Traps. It's one of the largest volcanic features on the Earth. Now, what happened there is that sudden cooling due to sulfurous volcanic gases released by the formation of the traps and the toxic gas emissions likely contributed to the die-off of the dinosaurs, the vegetation, and most of the life on the planet. So there's been evidence of this, and we've known about it for quite a long time. What happens is when these sulfurous gases enter the atmosphere, in the short term, it will cool. But in the long term, with the carbon dioxide, it will warm things up. So you'll have these wild sort of climate swings in a relatively short period of time, from cold to warm. And some thought that the Deccan Traps could be responsible for the warming that happened just before the impact. So, which was it? Was it asteroid? Was it volcanism? Or a combination of both? You know, the proverbial double whammy, as Steve referred to earlier in the episode. Now, scientists have been back and forth on this over the decades, and so far the asteroid impact seems to have the lion's share of the scientific community's approval. But there are still clutches of scientists in the volcanism camp to some degree. Today's news is more research just published the other day. The title of the paper is, and the title gives it away, Asteroid Impact, Not Volcanism, Caused the End Cretaceous Dinosaur Extinction. So this was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
Yeah.
Thank you, Kara. Uh-huh. Researchers at Imperial College London, the University of Bristol, and University College London claim that only a large asteroid impact could have created the doomsday conditions that wiped out all dinosaurs across the globe. Dr. Alessandro Chiarenza, who's with the Department of Earth Science and Engineering at Imperial, was the lead author of the study, and here's how she sums it up. We show that the asteroid caused an impact winter for decades, you know, think nuclear winter, impact winter, and that these environmental effects decimated suitable environments for dinosaurs. In contrast, the effects of the intense volcanic eruptions were not strong enough to substantially disrupt global ecosystems. Our study confirms for the first time quantitatively, a bold statement, that the only plausible explanation for the extinction is the impact winter that eradicated dinosaur habitats worldwide. Now, there's also another part of this research. At the same time, they're adding that the volcanic eruptions actually helped life recover faster after the mass extinction event. So the volcanoes, they release the particles that block the sunlight from reaching the Earth's surface, but they also release the carbon dioxide. And the greenhouse gas stays in the atmosphere long after the sun-blocking aerosols dissipate, and this warms the planet. In the long term, the volcanic warming helps restore many habitats. And perhaps it set the stage for the rise of the smaller mammals, which ultimately forged, well, us, which we came from. And they said that we provide new evidence to suggest that the volcanic eruptions happening around the same time might have reduced the effects on the environment caused by the impact, particularly in quickening the rise of temperatures after the impact winter. This volcanic-induced warming helped boost the survival and recovery of the animals and plants that made it through the extinction, with many groups expanding in its immediate aftermath, including birds and mammals.
That's an interesting way to look at the question. You know, it's always fascinating to how do scientists look for evidence to answer a specific question, you know? And so this is a new, I think, new angle to this, but it is consistent with the emerging overwhelming consensus, in my opinion, that the asteroid impact was the extinction event. The Deccan Traps maybe contributed to the overall, you know, situation, but the dinosaurs would not have gone extinct were it not for the asteroid, the non-avian dinosaurs.
And that's what they concluded. Yep. So, but hey, I guess thank goodness for the Deccan Traps and their emissions, mm-hmm. because perhaps it helped save enough mammals that it led to us being here and doing this podcast. So mm-hmm. thank you, Deccan Traps.
Cool. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Bombas Socks.
Do you guys know that Bombas makes the most comfortable socks in the history of feet? That's a bold claim, but honestly, I kind of buy it. I don't know. I love my Bombas. What about you guys?
They're the bomb.
Bombas is the only sock I wear now because it's both comfortable and casual and corporate. And what I mean by that is I've gotten compliments on my socks by my clients in my office. That is the truth.
I love, love, love their athletic socks because they have incredible arch support. They're super cushy. And I wear the little ankle socks and they never squish themselves down into my shoes. The best.
And you know, guys, they don't just feel good, but the company actually does good. They help give back to the most vulnerable members of our community, especially during times like today. You know, everybody needs help. So for every pair of socks you purchase, Bombas donates a pair to someone in need.
So give a pair when you buy a pair and get 20% off your first purchase at bombas.com/skeptics. That's bombas.com/skeptics for 20% off your first purchase.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Kara, you alluded earlier in the show that you were going to talk about visualizing data, which is always interesting, you know, because, you know, it's very important how you communicate data, you know, especially scientific data, and it's very easy to manipulate it.
Right. And I mean, that's ultimately the thesis of what this conversation is going to be, is that you have to really understand your data. You have to understand the statistical analyses that have been used upon that data, but you also have to understand a little bit, or a lot, I should say, about human behavior, psychology, consumption, persuasion, if you want to do data visualization well. So there's an article that's what sort of made me want to talk about this topic, is I came across a recent article in Quartz by Catherine Ellen Foley called How Bad COVID-19 Data Visualizations Mislead the Public. And she kind of went through, she's a science reporter, and she went through like different states. She sort of looked at it using those categories and some of the public health data that was given out by those states using what we might refer to as like an infographic, right? Mm-hmm. A way to visualize data. And she went through and was like, this I see problems with. And then this was actually presented in kind of a good way that gets the information across. And I wanted to get a little bit deeper into that. So I pulled a few different articles and actually, you know, most of this is science communication work or education work. But I did actually find, I think, one of my favorite articles that's a peer-reviewed study, but it is in the... Where is it, Evan? In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences?
Oh, the PNAS.
Oh, yeah, it's in the PNAS.
Grow up!
And it's a colloquium paper called Data Visualization Literacy, Definitions, Conceptual Frameworks, Exercises, and Assessments. I really like this study. It was published last February because it's actually just trying to present a sort of new way to learn about data visualization. So they used kind of a new teaching platform, data visualization literacy idea, and then they used it to teach 8,500 different people about data visualization, and then they looked at some of the outcomes. But what was most interesting to me was not so much the results, right, but the actual methodology that they used. What did they think was relevant? What are the ways to go about doing data visualization that are the most impactful? Because we know for a fact that data can be manipulated, right? Like, yeah, that's an that's just like a statement that we've talked about for years on the show. You can take a set of data and you can present it graphically or infographically in a way that tells somebody the opposite of what the data actually show. That is sort of like a nefarious intention. So let's put that in a different bucket right now. If somebody says, okay, I'm going to look at the data and I'm going to try and persuade somebody of the opposite or of something that's like far and away that you would have to be very motivated to try to interpret the data in that way. Okay, that's an extreme and it does happen. But also, I think well-meaning individuals will often, who have poor data visualization literacy, will often tell a story with the data that is not really reflective, or maybe it's not the most ideal way to tell that story. So there's a few things going back to this Quartz article that that the science writer who wrote it points out. One of them is clutter. So a lot of times we'll see an infographic and it's just full of numbers, or like there's not enough white space on the infographic. It's just a lot of information all at once and it's too much to process. And so when data is visualized that way, oftentimes it doesn't end up resonating with us at all because there's just too much shoved into a small space, right? We've all come across those kinds of fact sheets. They also talk about the fact that doing a snapshot of data but not contextualizing it is not very helpful. So in this Alabama data visualization, it only showed, you know, X number of laboratory confirmed cases, X number of hospitalizations, X number of deaths with no context. Is it trending? How does it compare? You know, how do the deaths compare to the test numbers? And that is not very helpful for us as, you know, consumers of this information to make sense of the trends that are happening in our local communities. She also talks a little bit, and I think that this is a very important thing. It goes back to the article in PNAS also, and that is using the appropriate mechanism. So let's say we're talking about graphs and charts or tables. Can we all think back to the last time that we took like a statistics class?
I don't want to think about it.
Oh boy, yeah, me either.
Did you guys even take statistics? Because
in college,
I didn't get an appropriate statistics education until I studied psychology academically.
Yeah, I did in medical school. That was really what
you
I
did. Went. Okay, that's good. I know that like psych students get a lot of stats, but then when I talk to my friends who are physicists or field biologists, they're like, I took like one multivariate stats class and I forgot everything. So one of the things that we remember is that let's say that you have your data collection mechanism, you're using some form of software and you've done all your research. Now you have all the raw data. And then you're going to start plugging it away. Let's say you want to use Excel and you plug in all of your independent variables and your dependent variables and you do all the things that are these words coming back to you guys. You do all the things that you need to do. And then you pick how you want to display it. And you can literally click through bar graph, line graph, pie chart. And it will auto-formulate a chart. But depending on the type of data that you're working with, that chart might be wildly inappropriate for telling the story of the data. Does that make sense?
Sure.
So, you know, this writer thinks that pie charts are like just generally crappy. Like they give you a warm and fuzzy feeling because you're like, look, everything adds up to 100%.
Oh, we like that. Yeah.
Yeah. But beyond that, they really don't show you much. They're like, it's like, oh, that category is slightly bigger. But when you have a bar graph, sometimes you can actually see the significant differences. But you can perceptually see the differences better because on the y-axis, you know, there's a physical distance difference. Whereas on a pie chart, it's like, I don't know, does 34% look kind of like 39%? Yeah.
Yeah, but
it's hard to make sense
of that.
But
when I'm calculating, like, you know, how much pie I want to eat, I love the pie chart.
that's probably the one time when it's most appropriate. Yeah, I would think. Also, like I said, a lack of context can be really unhelpful. Sometimes presenting very low numbers on large scales can be unhelpful. So they talk about an Arkansas data visualization where they're talking about, you know, one of the things we discuss a lot on the show, which is pre-existing health conditions and how much they might predispose you or that there's like a high level of comorbidity with COVID-19. The problem is the numbers in a percentage sense are quite low. So they're showing percent of cases with diabetes was 7.4%. Percent of cases with heart disease was 2.7%. But when you actually translate that to actual numbers of patients, it's, you know, hundreds or even thousands of people. But when they're visualizing something on a scale of 0 to 100 and they're showing 2.2% or 1% or even 10%, what ends up happening is that you as a consumer see that and your immediate reaction is, oh, that's not so bad. It's mm-hmm. barely taking up the whole space. Mm-hmm. The space is 100% and they're only giving me 2% of that. It looks like a tiny sliver. Maybe I'm not at risk. And that's really what it comes down to when we talk about data visualization is raw data. So often when you're working as a researcher or even if you're working in marketing or something like that, raw data so often becomes a number on a page or a point, but it actually contextually translates into things that have a massive impact in people's decision making, into people's behavior, their health, their wellness, their psychology. And so really thinking about those core issues are very important. So real quick, I came across another great article that talks about some of the biggest issues with data visualization today. This was written last year in Medium. And there are some really good takeaways here. They basically divide it into three main issues. When it comes to the data itself, they really break it down into three important problems. One is that organizations put a lot of resource into collecting data without a real plan as to how they're going to disseminate it. So just more data is not always better, right? We love operating under an idea of like big data, but we don't do the time to like pre-produce what it is we're trying to understand. And so the issue is it really important to just get more numbers if we don't even know why we want those numbers or what kinds of decisions we're going to be making based on those numbers? Probably not. Those kinds of questions need to be asked beforehand. Also, how does the raw data compare to the visualization? Are the themes and the conversations that we're trying to have, is the context provided in such a way that the data visualization is more meaningful to us? And is it actually translating what the data have been telling us based on our analysis? The other question, it has to do with teaching, which is why is it that data visualization, or maybe we should say literacy around data visualization, is not a part of current curricula, even though it's such an important part of how we consume information? And should we have more actual curriculum at the elementary and secondary and even collegiate levels of how we develop this? Because I would venture to guess, and I want you guys to tell me if you agree, and there may be some generational issues here, but most people don't learn about this until they take a statistics course.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with don't that. You think? Sure. This is not
even
stuff.
Yeah. And even there, some of the basic things like, do you guys remember the difference between nominal, ordinal, interview, and ratio data?
God, no.
Right? But those things really matter because you present them all differently. When we're talking about nominal things, these are categories. When we're talking about ordinal, we're talking about number. It being along a continuum. Interval has to do with numbers, but ratio has to do with those numbers being interspaced consistently. Like, these are important things when you're showing men versus women versus, you know, nonconforming or non-binary. That's nominal data. When you're showing ages in ranges, that's interval data. When you're showing how satisfied somebody was with something, low, medium, or high satisfaction, that's ordinal data. And all those things are presented differently. They're not only manipulated statistically differently, but they need to be presented differently. But then the last thing that this other article I came across talked about, which was so important, and we mention it sometimes on the show, is bias, bias, bias. And bias comes in at every stage of the conversation. It comes in to how we collect the data, it comes into how we analyze the data, and then it comes into how we visualize the data and communicate the findings to individuals who may not have the same background as us in understanding things like error bars or understanding things like uncertainty. So having those conversations, understanding individual bias, can help us be more responsible as presenters of data, but also it can help us be more educated, as consumers of data. Ultimately, though, I do think that the onus should be on the data visualization authors, the graphic designers, the scientists, the public health officials, the individuals that are putting out infographics. Really need to be thinking about who is your audience, what do they want to understand, what's the easiest takeaway here, that can go a long way. And one kind of just personal example I would give of this is that we recently put together a poster presentation for a research project that we did with my research group at the university where I'm working on my PhD. And Steve, have you seen these academic posters that are like the new poster versus the old one that's just super cluttered with like text and bullet points and lots of images and things like that? The new version of the poster has one big chunk. It's about a third of the poster dedicated to a one or two sentence finding. Like, this is what we found. And then you go in and you talk a little bit about your method section and you talk a little bit about your discussion and your results and, you know, you do it in the right order. But the big takeaway on the poster is these were our findings. And now other scientists, when they're at a poster presentation and they're walking through thousands of research findings, don't have to dig for it. They can say, oh, that's what it was about. I want to learn more, or that's not relevant to my work. I'm going to move on to the next one. But that just started within the last several years. Even within the sciences, we've had a big problem in this field.
Yeah, I haven't seen that format yet.
Yeah, I might chat you it so you can see what it looks like. It's very different, but it's actually really effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that it's one of those areas where like people don't know about it, pay attention to it, but it has a profound effect on how we consume
Massive.
Information.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and misinformation.
Because
again,
yeah,
I left out of the conversation, the idea of making it look like it, you know, tells you a story that it doesn't tell you, because that actually has like a negative kind of agenda to it. I'm just talking about the mistaken bad visualization, unintentionally misleading.
So depressing. Like, oh boy, I can't trust anything.
Well, you can.
Well, you
but that's really where it's important,
right?
To look at sources, right? It's really important to. And also, I think there is a certain level of basic understanding that goes into this. If you look at an infographic and you go, I don't understand this. What are they trying to tell me? That's a bad infographic. So much of it is less about whether or not it's manipulating the data and more about whether or not it's even an effective tool for communication.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy. Short and sweet.
Yeah.
Any guesses, guys?
Internal mechanism of a slot machine.
Very close.
Ooh. Not bad, Bob.
Oh.
Jim Kelly wrote in. He said, hi, Jay. I think this week's noisy is the sound of the ball falling in a pachinko machine. Hmm. You guys know what those are?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a casino gambling type of machine. I think they're very popular in Asia. You have a metal ball and you drop it in the machine some way or another, and it
bounces
hits a bunch of metal pegs.
Yeah.
It's like the
Plinko.
Yeah, they did a knockoff of it. Plinko on Price is Right.
That is incorrect, but interesting.
Oh. It's not Plinko.
Oh wait, it's incorrect that that's the noisy.
Right?
That's
that is not the noisy.
Like Plinko. Right?
It is not a pachinko.
They did do that on The Price is Right.
So, a frequent guesser, Caleb, has written in. He said, "To Who's That Noisy? I think it's some kind of ratcheting lever. The image that comes to my head is a mix between a roller coaster and a vending machine. I don't even know what that means, but I haven't missed a week of guessing yet, and I'm not stopping now."
All right, Caleb.
Good job. That's not correct, my friend. Alan Champion wrote in. He said, hi, Jay. Greetings from Albury, New South Wales. My initial reaction was that it reminded me of the escapement mechanism of the old clock in Salisbury Cathedral. That's the tall building in England so beloved of certain Russian tourists. That is also interesting, but not correct. I have a winner. Already we're at the winner, guys. Can you believe it? Oh, Chris boy, Ford wrote in. Chris he Ford. Said, it sounds like an internal recording. Now, this he might not be exactly correct, but damn close enough. It sounds like an internal recording of a KISS pinball machine. Like the boot up sound, which means like when you put your money in. And he goes on to describe, like, first heard is the quarter being inserted and traveling into Gene Simmons' pocket, followed by the sounds of the pinball paddles. I know, isn't that funny, Evan?
KISS? How
do you know? Yeah, so
it's KISS's machine.
So this is a pinball machine. So the person that sent this in, Matt Rappaport, he said that this is a pinball machine that was in his parents' basement. So he was over there and he tried it out and then he recorded it for me. He did not tell me exactly what kind of pinball machine it was, but these are pinball machine sounds, people. This is what a pinball machine sounds like. I miss having access to a pinball machine.
Do we have to explain what a pinball machine is?
No.
No.
Okay. I refuse not to. No, we're not doing that.
The kids, they've got the pinball machine apps on their phone.
They do? Okay. Because yep. It used to come as part of the games package with, I think, Windows 95 or something, you know. Used to be
hilarious.
Yeah, they were fun. All right, this next noisy is, it's about 30 seconds. You got to listen to it to hear all the different things that it goes through. This noisy was sent in by a listener named Rob Tilsley. So whatever it is, it gets going there.
Yeah.
So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or, and this is important, if you heard something cool this week, come on, send it to me. I need it because you know what? I go through everything and I pick the best one every week. So please send it to WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve.
Yes.
Are you excited?
Always, can't you tell?
Yeah, right. I am talking to you from Nexus, okay? I consider myself Nexus because me and Ian have been killing ourselves to get the studio in shape. The studio is in fantastic shape. We are now doing all the fine tuning. We have 1 month to land this conference, and we have done an excellent job. For those of you who did not hear last week's podcast, we have some great news. Andrian is going to be our keynote speaker.
Yeah.
Woohoo!
That's awesome.
If you don't know who Anne is, Anne was part of Cosmos Series 1 and the reboot of Cosmos, which came out a few years ago. She was heavily involved, directed episodes. She
wrote it.
Yeah, she was one of the writers
of the writers of all three series.
That's right. So we have a great list of speakers this year. We have, like I said, Andrian is going to be our keynote. We have Susie Wiles, Richard Wiseman, Bill Nye, Dr. David Hu, Leanne Lord, Andrea Jones-Roy, Dr. Steve Novella, Shane C. Campbell-Staton. A couple of details about the conference. Whatever you spend on tickets for this year will be subtracted from your tickets to the live in-person conference that we'll be having in 2021 in Atlantic City. So you're really just getting two conferences for the price of one, if you think about it. We'd really like you to join us. Steve, what do you have to say?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really looking forward to it, I have to say, because you know, I think that even without the pandemic, I think there's a digital conference could be a lot of fun. And we may just start doing them just because they're a good idea, not because we have to, you know?
Yeah, one thing we talked about was that if we, you know, when we do the live conference next year in person, that we would have a digital version of it running parallel the whole time. Like, of course, showing you what's going on the main stage, but then having it, you know, a separate MC and everything. We're throwing around ideas. That's one of the ideas that we really like, because we think that this type of live interactive content actually gives people that can't make it to the conference in person, gives them the ability to still join us.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do a name that logical fallacy this week. This email comes from Noel, who writes, "Hello, Rogues. I believe this question is a question for Steve. Often when arguing on the internet, I often see arguments dismissed as unoriginal, regardless of how well thought out it is. It always feels to me like a way of avoiding making any real counter-argument rather than a legitimate criticism. I don't think I've ever heard this subject handled in the SGU, and I'm very interested in what Steve, the SGU's resident authority on logical fallacies, has to say about dismissing arguments as unoriginal." So what do you guys think if you would apply a logical fallacy to that?
What's the context again?
I can think of a lot on the other side, but like, I'm trying to think of like,
right?
Because they're all unoriginal.
Exactly.
Well, I guess if you argued, like, say, oh, that paper wasn't published in a peer-reviewed journal, they say, oh, you always say that. That's, you know. The thing that's interesting is we use this criticism quite a bit. You know, we often jokingly say, oh, that old chestnut, you know.
Yeah.
Like, because.
But that's because we've already debunked it.
Yeah, right. And because oftentimes the purveyors of pseudoscience are unoriginal, meaning that they are regurgitating talking points that have been presented to them and they're not thinking their way through it. So like when, you know, creationists say, oh, survival of the fittest is an oxymoron. It's like, yeah, you didn't come up with that. You know, that's something that's been spreading around the creationist subculture for 60, 70 years, and it's been debunked endlessly. Or they say evolution violates the second law of thermodynamics. Again, it's like, that's not something that you came up with, or is not the product of any serious thought. It is just a talking point, you know, that is that you have
exactly.
are regurgitating.
That's the thing. Not everything you say is a rhetoric, is a form of rhetoric. Like, not everything you say is a line in your argumentation, your logical argumentation strategy. Mm. Sometimes you just say things when you're having conversations with people. So if somebody says blah, 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 and you go, oh God, I've heard that one before, you're not committing a logical fallacy. You're telling them that this is not new territory. Now, if you say, I don't want to have this conversation, you can maybe, I don't know, say, see these 10 blog posts on the topic, or, you know, we've had this conversation before. Here's, you know.
Yeah, so that's, I don't think that's what,
about it.
I don't think that's what Noel is talking about, though, because in the world of informal logical fallacies, context is everything. And often when people like falsely make accusations of a logical fallacy, it's because they are getting the context wrong. So in this case, like if I said, oh, like the thermodynamic argument for creationism is old, it's been endlessly debunked, and someone tried to claim that was a logical fallacy, they would be missing the context. And so what you're getting to the context here. The question is, are you pointing out that an argument is old and unoriginal because you're also pointing out that it has been long debunked? And the people who are still promoting that argument are intellectually dishonest for doing so, and they have no counter argument to the debunking, right? So that's all important for context.
Right.
But you still have to counter the argument. But if you're dismissing an argument simply because it's not original, that is a logical fallacy. And so it's like saying it's very similar. It's a type of ad hominem. You know, anytime you dismiss an argument, not because of its content, but because of either the messenger or the form, it's some type of, you know, you're arguing, you're saying the person's unoriginal, right? So it's kind of arguing to the person. Or if you're saying the argument's unoriginal, it's a non sequitur, which is kind of a generic logical fallacy, but it's a form of argument. The opposite of an argument from authority.
But that's given that you are engaging in an argument.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that we're forgetting is that a lot of times, like, you know, we've talked about sea lioning or we've talked about things that happen online when somebody says, blah, blah, blah. It's like, I can choose also not to engage. And I'm not committing a logical fallacy when I do that.
No, I don't think that's what he's saying either.
Right.
So choosing not to engage because
because you're tired. Yeah,
but that you're not saying you're wrong because I choose not to engage with you, right? That's a logical fallacy. It's like you could say you're an idiot, but if you say you're wrong because you're an idiot, it becomes a logical fallacy.
Exactly.
Right? You could say that's an old argument or that's not an original argument, but if you're saying that argument is wrong because it's unoriginal, that's a logical fallacy. Or if you say, I'm not going to bother to make a counter argument, then it's not even, you're not saying it's wrong. You're just saying, if you're saying I don't have the time or you're intellectually dishonest or you're sea-lining me or whatever, that you're not saying, therefore the argument is wrong, right? As long as you don't take that specific step of saying, you know, the argument has to be wrong because of logic and evidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Not because of the way the person's presenting it or whether or not it's original to them or whether or not they're being intellectually honest or dishonest. So you have to separate those two things, mm-hmm. right? Just like with the argument from authority, it's okay to say that, you know, I trust this guy because he has the credentials and everything versus this claim is correct because somebody with authority is saying it and only because somebody with authority is saying it, right?
Right. That's two different things. In one instance, you're referring somebody to where the argumentation has taken place legitimately.
Yeah.
And in another case, you're saying it's true because a smart person said so, or
right.
your ideas is exactly. wrong because I've heard it before.
Yeah, it'd be pretty rare though, right? It'd be pretty rare for someone to say.
I would think so too. We couldn't even think of an example.
Therefore, you're wrong.
Well, I think the bigger context here is that sometimes, you know, we will point things out for important context, and then people try to twist that into a logical fallacy. Right. So I might say that, I am reflexively skeptical of this person's claims because they have a history of fraud. And somebody might say that that is an ad hominem or that's poisoning the well. It's like, no, I'm putting into context this person's mm-hmm. current right. claim. They're making a claim that is out of the mainstream and that sounds implausible and they have been convicted of fraud before. What are the odds that somebody with a long history of committing cons and frauds is the one who discovered free energy? You know what I mean? Just to pull an example. Yeah. That's important for context. It doesn't make the claim wrong, but it is important to try to decide like how skeptical you should be of the claim. Right? So saying that a consensus of appropriate experts all agree with this doesn't make the claim right, but it means you should take it seriously. And if you should have a good reason not to accept it. You should have either enough expertise to be able to challenge other experts, or you have to have some good reason to think that those experts are tainted or biased, or they're not, you know, they're ideological or whatever. But it shifts the burden of proof, right? So in a way, so if you're a con artist, you have a higher burden of proof. It's like the boy who cried wolf, you know. The third or fourth time a wolf actually came, but he had a little bit of a higher burden of proof given the fact that he falsely cried wolf three times. If you're a con artist, your burden of proof goes up. If you're disagreeing with a panel of experts, you have a higher burden of proof.
Exactly. If you're making an extraordinary claim, the burden of proof is going to be on you and not the people. Yeah, I mean, and all that context does matter. It really matters.
But that's not the same thing as saying, therefore, this claim is wrong for that reason alone or correct or whatever. That's where the logical fallacy comes in. And that's the context that people forget when they misuse those kinds of logical fallacies. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There is a theme this week, or these are all news items.
Wow.
But there's a theme to these news items. Are you ready? The theme is regeneration.
Regeneration.
Regenerative medicine. Okay. It'll become obvious when I say the items. Here we go. Item number one, scientists were able to keep pancreas slices alive in culture for up to 10 days and demonstrate regeneration of insulin-producing cells when stimulated by a growth factor. Item number two, medical researchers successfully coaxed damaged adult mouse lungs to grow new air sacs, increasing lung capacity and oxygen exchange. And item number three, researchers were able to reprogram adult cells normally present in the inner ear into sound-sensing hair cells using only 4 transcription factors. Bob, go first.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Pancreas slices alive in culture for up to 10 days and demonstrate regeneration of the insulin-producing cells. That would be cool. Really got nothing to say about it. Let's see. The next one here, this one looked good. Coaxing damaged adult mouse cells to grow new air sacs, increasing. I really want this to be true, and I may just make it science because of that. And then the third one, stem cells into sound sensitive. Oh, wow. All right. I want that one to be true for mom. So I'll say that the pancreas is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Pancreas slices alive in culture for up to 10 days, demonstrating regeneration of the cells when stimulated by a growth factor. Okay. that sounds remarkable and good. I think that one will be science. Medical researchers successfully coaxed damaged adult mouse lungs to grow new air sacs. And increasing lung capacity? Increasing lung capacity from before?
Prior to the intervention. Yeah.
Prior to the damage that they suffer? I mean, getting it back to normal or increase it beyond what
it was? I didn't say normal. It was damaged and then they treated it and it was better.
And it was better than when it started.
Better
it
than
says they made
or
new
got,
air
or sacs. Got better. I guess that's what I'm. It got better.
It is what it is. It does not imply that it got all the way to normal. It didn't imply anything like that. It just says it grew new air sacs.
Well, there might be a little wiggle room in here. That one's kind of scaring me a little bit. Maybe that one. The last one about reprogramming adult cells, normally present in the inner ear. Gee, well, I've never heard of this. Into sound sensing hair cells using only 4 transcription factors.
Would you like to know what a transcription
factor
is?
Yeah, could I know that, please? Thank you.
Sure. I don't know that it's going to change your thinking, but essentially these are factors that alter how much a gene will be active making protein, right? So, you know, every cell has every gene, right? All of your DNA is in every cell. The difference between different cells is some genes are turned on and some are turned off, right? Some are transcribing their DNA into proteins and other genes are not. And it's not all or nothing. There's different, it could be up or down. So by using only 4 transcription factors, changing the rate at which 4 different genes were producing proteins, they were able to turn these cells into sound sensing hair cells.
Thank you, Steve. Yes.
They were able
yes.
to reprogram their genetic activity.
Right. Reprogram, repurpose in a sense. So therefore, yeah, I'll guess I'll go with the mouse lungs because I think increasing lung capacity, something about that. I'm not quite certain. The other two, you know, just as well. But the mouse ones, I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Kara.
This is a tough one.
It is.
I think it's sort of like all of these things could be possible, but also I think a lot of it has to do with some keywords that you put in there. So pancreas slices alive in culture. Okay, so that's not hard to do, to keep slices alive in culture. 10 days, not hard to do. Regeneration of beta cells or insulin-producing cells.
That's correct.
Immune beta cells. Yes. Yeah. Stimulated by growth factor. That's huge, right? Because adults who need to produce more insulin, we burn those cells out. That's what diabetes is. So yeah. I could see this being really important. I could also see this happening because I think we have a lot of money in diabetes research. So a step like this seems plausible, even though it's a big, important step. Doesn't mean it'll translate into drug treatment, though. I think that the mouse lungs being coaxed to grow new air sacs also seems plausible. My biggest concern with this is that these are in adult mice, and I don't know how they would have done it, obviously using certain types of factors or certain types of stem cells or something. But because it's in adult mice, I don't know. I don't know if they would have to do this in like a younger mouse model. And then the last one, again, these are adult cells. And so the idea here, right, is that your hair cells die over time. That's why you can't detect high-pitched sounds. And like the more that you rock out, you know, it's like rock star drummers and stuff are like very deaf because they're, you know, burning out their hair cells faster. So to be able to reprogram non-hair cells, that's what I'm assuming you're saying, right? Non-hair cells of the inner ear to become hair cells.
Yes.
Only 4 transcription. I don't know how many transcription factors it would usually take to do something like that. Also, same thing. I don't know if this would be in adults. Maybe they did it in younger, or it required some sort of stem cell, I would think. So both of those are the ones that bother me, the two adults. The stuff in vitro, I think you can do all sorts of cool stuff in vitro that never translates to in vivo. Okay. I think that our lungs actually do get better in time. So I think there's a natural inclination for our lungs to improve. Like, I know smokers can regenerate and do a lot of good stuff with their lungs. I don't think hair cells are supposed to come back naturally. So you would have to force it. So just based on that, I'm going to say the hair cell one is the fiction. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. And more left? Barriers.
And
maybe.
Jay. So you guys are all spread out, right? So it was Bob one.
So you didn't sweep us.
Evan two and Kara three. Okay, so no help for you, Jay.
Yeah.
All right, so the first one about the pancreas slices, I think that one is science. You know, I know that there is a ton of labs working on things like this, trying to regenerate organ tissue and everything, and I think this is one of the ones that is achievable. And then popping down to the last one about the inner ear cells, you know, I have a personal connection to this because, you know, Steve and I both suffer from
tinnitus.
Because nobody knows how to say that word correctly.
Tinnitus.
So anyway, so we got these problems with our ears, and I want this one to be true, so therefore it's true. I know that scientists have been experimenting with this exact type of stuff because I read about it all the time. Mm-hmm. I just don't know how much they've achieved. I don't know if this was true. But I will tell you, I don't think the one with the mouse lung cells, I don't think that one is science. I really don't think that one is science, largely because when mice smoke, we really don't want to do anything to help them because we're angry at them. No, I just think I think this one is not the science, largely because I don't think we'd be spending that much energy on research right there. How about that?
So we're all spread out, which I always like. So I guess we can take these in order. We'll start with number one. Scientists were able to keep pancreas slices alive in culture for up to 10 days and demonstrate regeneration of the insulin-producing cells when stimulated by a growth factor. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is science.
Nah, whatever.
All right, Bob.
Science.
Yeah, so this is actually a little bit harder than I think you're giving a credit for, Kara. So I'll say two of these, including this one, are science because they are incremental advances.
Right.
And one of them is a few steps beyond where we are. And there's also something else different about it, but we'll get to that when we get to that one. So in this one, you know, so pancreatic slices are, you know, they're alive. It's a thin slice of the pancreas, but there's enough structure there that the cells can stay alive for a while. The trick is getting oxygen to them and nutrients to them. But also it's very difficult to do this with the pancreas specifically because the pancreas digests itself when you do this and it just falls apart. So this is the first time they've been able to get pancreas slices to stay alive for 10 days.
Wow. So even that, just that right
just
there.
Just that is new. But that allowed them to follow the beta cells for 10 days for long enough to see that they actually do regenerate. So there was before that, they weren't able to see that because they couldn't keep the cells alive long enough to follow them out, you know, over 10 days. This has implications for diabetes, right? Yeah. The beta cells of the pancreas are the ones that produce insulin. That's diabetes. Type 1 is there's an autoimmune disease that wipes out the beta cells. Type 2 is what Kara said, when we just burn them out because of genetics or insulin resistance, obesity, et cetera, so-called metabolic syndrome. In any case, so if this, again, this, and this is true sort of all of these to an extent, that, you know, for the short term, this technology is about enabling research, right? It's not about directly translating into a treatment. It's like, oh, good, now we have a model where we can study the pancreas cells and, you know, the beta, the islet cells, and we could see, you know, we could test to see what kills them, what helps them, you know, and maybe we will be able to coax the pancreas to regenerate more insulin-producing cells eventually. But in the short term, this will just allow research to proceed more quickly. But yeah, so this was actually a pretty big deal because this is, but it is an incremental advance sort of in this research.
I had no idea that you couldn't suppress them from just eating themselves.
Yeah, they
that's amazing.
Well, now they can, right? But they couldn't before. Yeah, so. All right, let's go on. Number two, medical researchers successfully coaxed damaged adult mouse lungs to grow new air sacs, increasing lung capacity and oxygen exchange. Jay and Evan think this one is the fiction. Everyone else thinks this one is science. And this one is the fiction. Good luck, guys.
Hey, Bob. Guessing works.
All right.
So
did you guys both just guess on this?
I pretty much did. I didn't read it.
So here's the big difference. The big difference between this one and the other two. The other two are dealing with cells. This one requires structure. And tissue, we're not there yet. We're not there yet. So the closest I could find, because I just made this one up, but then I had to make sure it was actually fiction, because half the time when I make up plausible things, they're true enough that I can't use them as a fiction. So, but what as late as 2018, so like the most recent research in this area that I dug up, we're just talking about regenerating the epithelial cells. Again, that would be sort of more in line with the other two, just causing the cells to reproduce or regenerate, but not growing actual air sacs. So that was sort of the leap, growing structures, that entire structures, not just cells. So I just made this up and just had to prove to myself that it wasn't actually true. And then, of course, this means that researchers were able to reprogram adult cells normally present in the inner ear into sound-sensing hair cells using only 4 transcription factors is science. And this, again, The researchers are not claiming this is anywhere near to being a treatment for anything. This is just great. Now we can produce the hair cells and study them, right? So this is now, again, a way to do research on hair cells because you can produce them in a petri dish, right? For example, by using these transcription factors. The cells that they were working on, they did it on a couple of different kinds of cells. They did it on embryonic fibroblasts, adult fibroblasts, and the one I mentioned in the item on adult inner ear support cells. So these are cells that would be already there, but they don't function directly for hearing. They're just support cells keeping the hearing cells going and alive. But they were able to turn those support cells into hair cells with 4 transcription factors. They, of course, studied a bunch of transcription factors, but they identified the 4 that were critical. And this is also in line with other research, which has shown that really very small numbers, 3 or 4, are able to really dramatically affect the cell type. You could even turn adult cells into stem cells with just 4 transcription factors,
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty amazing that you could have so much control over a cell with so few genes, but that's what the research has found. So again, this is, unfortunately, this is not the kind of thing that's going to be turned into a treat. It's not in the pipeline to be a treatment. It's just, oh, great, this will really help our ability to research, why hair cells die, what kind of things are toxic to them, and maybe what kind of treatments might help them regenerate. So these kind of basic science discoveries usually take 20-30 years to translate into a treatment, if they ever do. That's probably a realistic time frame. The kind of stuff that's coming online now, I first heard about 20-30 years ago. That's about the lag.
Right. And that's in an adult mouse model. Like, think about just in a petri dish.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I came across 1 and 3. I'm like, oh, these are two good, similar regeneration items. Maybe I'll just make a theme out of it and make up a third one. So that's what I did.
Proud of you.
Thank you. I know this one was a little different,
but I thought
I thought that you were able to reason your way through it a little bit because of the air sacs. That is a pretty significant advance beyond where we are right now. Okay, Evan, give us a quote.
Pulling bad science apart is the best teaching gimmick I know for explaining how good science really works. And that was written by Ben Goldacre from his book.
Cool.
I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that.
Classic quote.
Great title.
Yeah. It's fun to read Ben. He's always a fun read. His great books, great columns.
All right. Thank you, Evan. Hey, thanks for joining me this week, guys.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Dr. Thanks, Steve.
You got it, man.
See you Friday.
And don't forget, we will be live streaming on Friday, 5:00 Eastern Time. Which we've been doing now for a few months. It's been a lot of fun. We've had a lot of good feedback. Jay, how many people do we have watching the live stream live? It's like 1,000 now, right?
Yeah, we're averaging 1,000.
About 1,000. That's a lot for a live stream. That's pretty good.
Yeah, nice.
A lot of bored people out there.
Yeah, and
that's why we're doing it, Bob.
On a Friday afternoon during happy hour?
It's highlight of my week.
I know, given the time slot, it's a good point, Evan. That's a lot for that time slot.
It is.
But it's been a lot of fun, I have to say. I think we're all enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so we'll see everybody for that. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.